So if you divide the play into a prologue, and then we've done two acts, now we're into act three, and I've entitled it just "The Son of God Gives Himself for the Life of the World." It starts with a scene that you know well at Bethzatha, and there's a man who's been there for 38 years. It's a beautiful scene, quite mysterious in many ways. All I wanted to point out to you is when you meditate on it again, notice Jesus' question to the man, because that's the key. He says, "Do you want to be healed?" We may not, you see, because do you want to be free? Do you want to be a saint? A decision to say yes to that is pretty demanding, so we might prefer to keep it in the too hard basket and drift. So does this man really want to be healed? Because that has implications for his behaviour and life and commitments and responsibilities, etc. Then we come to... But he heals that man. It happens to be on a Sabbath. And so he gets into trouble. Well, here we are, chapter 5, verse 16. The Jews started persecuting Jesus. And we've got the same picture in the synoptics. Because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. And here's Jesus' beautiful answer to them. My Father's still working, so why shouldn't I? They're saying you shouldn't work on the Sabbath. It's an important rule. It's practice, but, well, my Father's still working. Every time a child is conceived, God is doing it. Every time a rose comes out, it's God creating. So God's working all the time. So what's your problem, says Jesus? Well, they did have a problem because of the importance of this rule. But he's a bit beyond rules. I think you know that. For this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill Jesus. And now comes a very important thing. Because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father. Thereby, brackets, in their opinion, making himself equal to God. I did mention it earlier, but I'll say it again if I may. Invariably, the people misunderstand Jesus. That's the point of the paradox of the drama. The woman thought, he said, "How are you going to give me water? You haven't even got a bucket." You know, and the Jewish man that came to see Jesus, Nicodemus, says, "How can I be born again? I can't go back into my mother's womb." So they're all getting it wrong. Well, these get it wrong too. They're saying that Jesus, when he calls Abba, God, he's making himself equal to God. Well, look at Jesus' reply. "Truly, I tell you, the Son of Man does nothing on his own. He only does what he sees the Father doing." That's his prayer. "Whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing." Of course I'm not making myself equal with God, he's saying. I only do what God gets me to do, tells me to do. I'm only carrying out my Father's will. I'm not equal with him. And a few verses later in 5:30, "I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek to do not my own will, but the will of the one who sent me." Jesus is the obedient, loving, affectionate, caring Son of the Father. There are not two gods in Christianity, or three. There's only one, Abba, the one Jesus calls Abba. A little later we read, there's the big festival. It's the festival of the year, the New Year celebration. And there's a lot happening in it. And on the last day of the festival, this is the big day, they're going to have a feast, the Jews. So the women's court, which is there's the inner sanctuary that only the high priest can go into, then there's the sanctuary, then there's the men's court, then there's the women's court, and then there's the Gentiles. They're allowed in out there somewhere. So in the women's court, there are candles and lights and streamers and bunting, and like it's a big show, and they're going to have dancing. Well, the men can go into the women's court, but the women can't come into the men's court. We're a funny lot, aren't we? Anyhow, that's how it was. Now, the last day, the women would go down, the young women presumably, with the carafes or whatever you call them, big things on their heads, and bringing up the water from the pool of Siloam, and the priest would take it and pour it on the altar, and it would wash down and wash through the city, like we might do on, used to do anyhow, on Easter Sunday, you know, the holy water, a cleansing of the whole city. Well, on the last day of the festival, the great day, it's called the Day of Rejoicing in the Torah, while Jesus was standing there, he cried out, "If you're thirsty, come to me." He's on this side of the stage in the dark, and over here is all this getting ready for the celebrations, full of light. But the real light's here, not there. So he says, "Come to me if you're thirsty." As the scripture says, out of his heart, sometimes translated, as long as you know that the Greek is not cardia, heart, it's koilia, it's inner being. But it's effectively the same. Out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water. There's a problem of translation here with that, because the Greek is actually ambiguous. I think it's meant to be ambiguous. So it's out of the heart of the Messiah, yes, but it's also out of the heart of the disciple. So you've got to, sometimes it's translated out of the disciple's heart. Well, please know that's not incorrect, but it's not what the Greek says, and the Greek is bigger than that. So it is coming out of the heart of the Messiah, but it's also coming out of the disciple's heart. Out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. It's pretty well what he promised the woman at Samaria. Now, he said this about the Spirit, which believers in him were to receive, for as yet there was no Spirit, because Jesus was not yet glorified. It's a very important text. And you know, have to know how to read it. Of course there was Spirit. Right from the beginning, the Spirit hovered over the waters at the baptism. The Spirit's all over the world, everywhere. The Spirit breathed creation. So it's not saying there's no Spirit, but it's saying the Spirit that Christianity is on about, which is the Spirit of Jesus and the Father, that's not given yet. It's bits of it, like at Cana. It's starting. But the fullness of the Spirit can only be given when Jesus has come to the fullness of his humanity and given his life on the cross. And it can only come from the resurrected heart of Jesus. So the Spirit that we experience as Christians, is given by the glorified, risen Christ from the fullness of his communion with God in heaven. Jesus was not yet glorified. That will be when Jesus is glorified. The hour of glory doesn't look too glorious, but that is the hour of glory, and the piercing there, that's what John will come back to, the water, the Spirit had poured from the heart of Jesus on the cross. Some verses from chapter 8, taken a little bit, not quite at random, but selected. Verse 24, "You will die in your sins unless you believe that I am Ego Eimi." In other words, you'll stay locked, distracted, whatever. And it's only if you can really believe that I am, meaning God is revealed through me. This is what God is. If you believe that, then you've got a chance of coming out of your slavery into the full freedom. If you don't, you'll be locked into your false gods and your false this and your false everything else. Verse 28, Jesus said, "When you've lifted up the Son of Man," we just saw that, "when you've lifted up the Son of Man, Then you'll know that I am. Then you'll see God revealed. Then you'll know who Yahweh is, the God of the burning bush. And that I do nothing on my own. Wouldn't it be good to be able to say that? That we never did anything except what God asked us to do. That'd be heaven. Please God, we'll get there one day. And I do nothing on my own, but I speak these things as the Father instructed me, and the one who sent me is with me. He's not left me alone. I always do what is pleasing to him. Here we've got Jesus at his deepest, and John's taking us into that deep place. I always do what is pleasing to him. A bit later, verse 31, if you continue in my word, you truly are my disciples, and you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Truth means knowing who God really is. That's what it always means. So if we knew who God is and grasped that, then that's what makes us free. And if the Son makes you free, you will really be free. So we can't liberate ourselves. We can't make our own resolutions and keep them and work our way up to heaven that way. I mean, we can do all that, but it won't get us very far. The journey of life is letting the Son make us free. Chapter 10, which talks about the Good Shepherd, and I won't do that with you. Jesus says at the end of that, and this is beautiful, I have other sheep that don't belong to this fold. I must bring them also. They'll listen to my voice, and there'll be one flock and one shepherd. That's Jesus' desire, the church's desire for unity. And it doesn't mean everybody becomes like us. It means that everybody, with all their differences, cultural differences, devotional differences, spiritual differences, that they all are in communion. Radical communion of love. And often that means thinking similarly and along many lines too. But the church is looking for unity, not conformity. And every time a person... I've never forgotten what happened to me in my ordination holiday. I was only 24. Just turned 24, and I was in a bus going to Northbridge because we had a holiday, if you could call it that, after ordination for 3 weeks, saying Mass in all the places that you know. And I was in a bus that went from Wynyard down to Northbridge through North Sydney and Cameray. And there was a man sitting next to me in the bus, and I'd been 7 years in a seminary, and a year before that in the novitiate. You can picture that. So you become pretty sensitized, really. And you're not in touch with the culture too much, except your own little culture. Beautiful culture, but, So I could feel this man was crying. He wasn't actually weeping, but I could feel he was really sad. I'm not sure I would feel it today, but I did then. And I also didn't think that you don't talk to people in buses, you know. So I just did spontaneously what I wish I could still do. I just said to him, what's the trouble? Why, something like that. And I was correct. He was really sad. But I didn't know till he talked that I was the reason he was sad. He started to unfold to me, and he said, I'm a Presbyterian. He said, and my daughter, not long ago, married a Catholic, and she's become a Catholic. And he said, and she's so happy. He said, and this is the bit that came, like this is desire. He said, I'd love to have what she has, but it would mean that all I'd ever lived was wrong. And this little wise 24-year-old spontaneously said, and I was right, of course, luckily, or gracefully, I said, no, it wouldn't. I said, no, it would mean that everything you've ever done, because he's got the desire, you see. If he didn't have the desire, I wouldn't have said anything. But he's got this, he'd long to have what his daughter's got. What if he'd long to have it? I said, no, everything you've ever done has brought you to a point where you want to take the next step of love and embrace. I said, do it. Join it. Do what, you know. Now, he got off the bus, I got off the bus, and that's it. I won't know, we won't till heaven what'll happen. But it left me with a simple conviction that when a person comes into the church, like through the RCIA or whatever, they don't stop being who they are. That would be terrible. They might have to stop certain things, like I've got to stop certain things and you've got to stop. We're always repenting, we're always growing and letting stuff go. But they bring their culture in, they bring their history in, they bring their family in, they bring all that. Because if they want to come into the church, something beautiful has already happened to them. They don't leave it behind. You don't stop being a Presbyterian and become a Catholic. You become a Presbyterian Catholic. Isn't that obvious? Or an Anglican Catholic, or a Islamic Catholic, or a Buddhist Catholic. Or you bring your culture in, and Catholicism is not a uniformity thing, it's a love thing. Anyhow, sorry, back to this. So I think that's what Jesus is saying and what the church is saying. He wants there to be one flock and one shepherd. Of course, he's the shepherd. John arranges his homilies around feasts because the Jewish community in Ephesus would have had their feast days, and they were Jewish feast days. We've still got most of them. Easter, Pentecost, you know, and they had a few others there. So that Hanukkah came in, that was a bit, we don't have that, but they did have it. And this was their feast of dedication, Hanukkah, when the temple was rededicated by the Maccabees in the middle of the 2nd century BC. And here's Jesus, lovely, first time he says this, the Father and I are one. Chapter 10, verse 30. Father and I are one. Well, he's not the Father, and the Father isn't him. One. They're in total communion. The Father and I are one. Now, again, misunderstand. The Jews took up stones to stone him. We're going to stone you, they said, because though you're only a human being, you're making yourself God. Was he? No way. Look at his response. Jesus, wait a minute, you stupid blooming people. Isn't it written in the Torah that you're so proud of, and so am I? Isn't it written there, I said you are gods? And it does say that in Psalm 82. If those to whom the word of God came were called gods, and the scripture cannot be annulled, can you say that the one whom the Father has sanctified and sent into the world, that's his mission, is blaspheming because he said, he didn't say I'm God, he said I am God's son. All my life comes from him, all my ideas come from him, all my agenda comes from him. Everything I have is a gift from the Abba to me. This is the human Jesus speaking. I'm God's son, he says. And then he makes a statement which will come back a few times. And it's, I think, the best statement we've got anyway. It's better than the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Chalcedon. We needed those councils. But as I hope you know, the theology of the church is contextualized always. So the Nicene Creed, in effect, it can't actually even be understood unless you understand the debates that were going on in the 4th century and then the later 5th century. So it's the debates that were going on that were struggling with who is Jesus in their Greek way. They were. So they're wonderful statements. But to understand them, you've got to do a little bit of Greek philosophy and you've got to do a lot of history. And, you know what I mean? That's what... much simpler than any of those, which we need to see if you study the history, but they are just affirming exactly what Jesus says here, and it's never said better. The Father is in me, and I am in the Father. That's enough. That's everything. If you misunderstand it, then you've got to get the theology in to correct you. But if just take it prayerfully, truthfully, beautifully, there's no finer way of talking about the relationship between Jesus and the one he called Abba than that. The Father is in me, and I am in the Father. The early church fathers, the Greek fathers, said he was like us in humanity so that we would be like him in divinity. So this is what we're all called to be able to say. God wants to say to you, I am in you and you are in me. Because we're living the life of Jesus. We've got his life in us. As Paul says, I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me. So we're all called to this. And the loveliest thing you could ever say would be, the Father is in me and I am in the Father. Now, we can all say that, but there's a few hiccups, like it's not entire, it's not complete, there's a bit of me that's not there, you know, and there's this kind of human unconverted stuff. There was no unconverted stuff in Jesus. The Father is in me and I am in the Father. In chapter 11, and I won't read it to you because it's too big to do now, there's the final of the great scenes, and it's Lazarus being brought to life. It's a very, very difficult scene to... It's wonderful, but it's quite difficult because, according to John, that's the reason Jesus got crucified. If you read up chapter 11, 12, you'll see that. This was the last thing that got them scared and made them kill Jesus. And it says that a number of times in John. The problem is, if it was all that, why isn't it in Matthew, Mark and Luke? It's not there. There's nothing about it there. And if it's that significant, it's very hard to imagine them leaving it out, I find. For them, the thing was emptying the temple was the key. And John's put that right back in chapter 2. So, somehow or other, there's this extraordinary scene about Lazarus, and it's about the resurrection and the life. And when we read the book of Lazarus, or the story of Lazarus, none of us hope that our brother, who died 4 days ago, that God will bring him back out of the grave, out of the tomb, and bring him home again. I mean, it's never happened. And if there are stories about it happening, they got a bit wonky, since something went wrong. It doesn't happen like that. And that's not the point. If we've come to the stage where we die, yes, Jesus will come and take us, not back to this life, might be the last thing we want anyhow, but into fullness of life. It's obvious to you, isn't it? This is about the resurrection. So that's what it's saying. Paul says not even death can separate us from the love of God. And that's what we're seeing here, dramatically done on stage in a powerful way we'll never forget, as long as we get the right message out of it. And at the end of that passage, in any case, this is beautiful as you're watching it on the stage in Ephesus. Jesus cried, Lazarus, come out. And that's what he'll cry to all of us when we're buried. The man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, his face wrapped in a linen cloth. And then Jesus said, and this is a key, it's wonderful, unbind him, let him go. So we start and we go back a bit and we think of the prodigal son we did yesterday. And the dad says to his elder brother, he says, look, son, he says, he's my son. He was lost and is found. He was dead and he's come back to life. So sometimes we're dead because people have got us bound. It might be the way we were taught when we were kids and we're full of fear of God. Could be a father who was really strong and domineering and whatever. It could be the culture we're in that's basically pagan and materialistic. not for many of you, but my culture's like that. And so Jesus is saying to us to unbind people. We read it the other day, a couple of days ago. Remove every yoke. You know, take the yoke off. Unbind people. Let them be free. Find out who they are and help them on their road to full freedom. That's what he wants them to do to Lazarus. So his death is a bond, a bound. Chapter 12, we have a... That's just a lovely icon there that I like. Anyhow, it's like a dance, isn't it? Jesus looking and his mother... She's giving him great consolation. But she can't stop him dying. But like, you know, she's just in pain over it. But look how lovely it is. And there's the beloved disciple and Mary and Jesus in a kind of a love dance, really. So love's what matters there. And Jesus says in 12:24, "Very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." So that's the end of part one, the public ministry of Jesus. I've done it terribly quickly, and you forgive me for that. Now we come to the second part, which is Jesus going back to the Father. And it starts, of course, with the Last Supper. As long as you remember that in the Last Supper... John tells us they were at supper, but he doesn't describe the Eucharist. The others have done that. He tells us what the Eucharist is really about. So, it's the scene of Jesus washing feet. I'll come to that in a minute. The text begins, "Before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." It reminds me of Luke's beautiful introduction to the Last Supper, where Jesus says, "I have longed and longed to eat this Passover with you before I die." Then he washes their feet. And you know that scene, I'll take it as read. And he says to them at the end, If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should do the same. You should wash each other's feet. I set you an example that you should do as I've done to you. And it's worth reflecting, I think, that that's the basic meaning of this. In Paul's letter to the Corinthians, chapter 11, and in the Synoptic Gospels, at the Last Supper, when Jesus takes the bread and the chalice and he says, "Do this in memory of me," what's he asking us to do? Well, partly he's asking us to come together on the day of the resurrection every week and do again what Jesus is doing at the supper, eat, love, all of that. But more fundamentally, he's asking us to do what he did, and that is care for each other. Love one another as I have loved you, which is what we're doing at the... That's what the Eucharist is about. It's not a... So that's basically what he wants us to do. Do what he's doing. And John's taking us to the meaning of the Eucharist, which is service of each other. Then we have Jesus' farewell speech. It's not in the Synoptics, and it goes for the rest of chapter 13 and then into chapter 14. John is modelling himself on the last testament of Moses, which is the whole book of Deuteronomy, which is painted as though, or described as though, Moses looking right back over the 40 years, looking out at the promised land, which he's not going to enter himself, and reminding people of what it's been all about. So here's Jesus at the end of his life, like Moses, spelling out for his disciples the meaning of what they've been doing together. And it's really... I'll just read what I've got there. We find that the speech, and this is... interesting and significant. The speech moves in and out of various time frames. As we listen, there are times when we can hear Jesus speaking at the supper. That's one time frame, current with the text. But there are other times when it's best to hear the words coming from Jesus on the cross. So don't get yourself too locked into the image of the supper. Some of the words Jesus speaks from at the supper in this are actually spoken from the cross. And some of the words Jesus speaks are spoken from heaven, like the book of the Apocalypse does. He's in post-resurrection. He's with God in heaven and he's speaking from there to us. You see, in John's Gospel, up till now, we've been following a pattern. There's Nicodemus, seen, and then a speech on being born again. There's a woman at the well, and then there's a speech from Jesus on water and life. There's a man born blind, which we didn't do, and there's a speech on light. Do you get it? Like, it's a meditation of John on the event, the described event. But when you come to the crucifixion, which is our whole focus now, you can't do that because Jesus can't die on a cross and then explain what's going on. So the explanation comes first. It's a reversal. John is preparing us to look at Jesus on the cross with our eyes open and washed clean and aware of the significance of Jesus' life-giving to Jesus. We know what it meant to the crowd a bit. We know what it meant to Pilate. We know what it meant to the high priest. We know what it meant to Judas, and like we could get all that. But what, Jesus couldn't say much on the cross, but what did it mean to him to give his life like that? Well, the answer to that is found in this meditation, chapter 14 of John. And we've got to hear Jesus speaking to us from the cross, from heaven, and at the supper. And it kind of moves around a bit. And I'm just picking just a little bits of it for you. Chapter 13, verse 34, we know this so well. I give you a new commandment. Love one another. It's interesting, he doesn't say love God. That's not new. Of course. But what's new about this is, look, the real test, and John will say in his letter later, if you say you love God and don't love your brother and sister, you're a liar. So love one another, that's the test, that's the reality. Love, and he said, look, and then he goes on further, just as I have loved you, you should love one another. By this everyone will know you're my disciples, if you have love one for another. Nothing new in that for us, we know it. But as Jesus said in Luke's Gospel to the man who asked who my neighbour is, he says, go and do it. Love one another. Love means give yourself. It doesn't mean like. That may not be possible. It doesn't mean invite everyone to the party, necessarily. It means give yourself to them for their own, for their spiritual good. Don't change because others behave badly. Stay like Jesus, stay loving. Father, they know not what they do. Forgive them. And we're reminded of that lovely text from Ezekiel 36. A new heart I will give you and a new spirit I will put within you. I will remove from your body the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. I'll put my spirit within you, says God, and make you follow my statutes and observe my ordinances. Well, here's Jesus. He's saying love one another. More deeply, he's saying, after my example, that love, this kind of love you've seen from me, give that to each other. But he's saying even more than that. He's saying, I'll give you my love so that you can love with my love, Jesus' love. So he gives us his heart so that we can have his heart to love with, his spirit to love with. Do not let your hearts be troubled. believe, be in love in God and believe in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If there were not, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and I'll take you to myself, so that where I am, you may be too. The way he did to Jairus' daughter, Talita kum, rise up. So in fact, the word used is the word for the resurrection. The way he did for the boy, the widow Nain, these are the ones, and the way he did for Lazarus. They're all meant to reinforce this message that when you and I die, finish this part of our existence, Jesus will be there, take you by the hand and embrace you into life. We know the way to the place where I'm going. You know the way, said Jesus. And Thomas, dear old Thomas, said, look, we don't know where you're going. How do we know the way? Very blunt and dull and slow and all that. And that's us, getting slow to get it. And Jesus said, I'm the way, I'm the truth, and I'm the life. So be united to me and you're okay. No one comes to the Father except through me. And I am there, and I'm there for you, and I'll take you with me to the Father. If you know me, you'll know my Father also. From now on, you do know him. You have seen him. And then Philip says, Lord, show us the Father. Then we'd be satisfied. That's all we want. We want to see God. Elijah wanted to see God. Moses wanted to see God. You want to see God. I want to see God. Well, Jesus said, have you been with me all this time and you still don't know me? To have seen me is to see the Father. Yes, we can't see God with these human eyes, but we can see Jesus. And we're looking at him, we're actually looking at the way God has revealed God to be in human form. The fullness of the Godhead dwells in this man, Jesus. There's a beautiful text from Corinthians, which I did with you, which you wouldn't be expected to know. It's God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. That's John, I beg your pardon, from the prologue. But here's Paul. It's God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Personal little thing. That's the text I used on my ordination card 52 years ago. So I liked it then, I still like it now. 2 Corinthians is a beautiful letter. It's God who said light shines out of darkness, has shone in our hearts, each of you and you as a community, to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus. You could say in the heart of Jesus. And, you know, people will see Jesus when they see you, and in seeing you and Jesus, they're seeing God. That's how we see God. And now, an extraordinary few verses. And in this is the Trinity, the Blessed Trinity, in a simple, lovely prayer statement. Still part of the lovely discourse of Jesus at the Last Supper. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments, and I'll ask the Father, and he'll give you another advocate to be with you forever. Jesus couldn't be with us forever. He could, mysteriously, through his Spirit, but he's human like us. He's got to die. He died far too young, but anyhow, he died. So like people who die, they're not with us like that again anymore. Well, but he says, I'm going to give you another advocate who'll be with you forever. Like there'll never be any time when he'll go, die, leave you. Advocate is a Latin word, ad vocare means to call. Often it's translated paraclete, because Greek is parakletos, means one who's the same, called alongside. So if you follow the Greek word, it's paraclete. If you look at the Latin, it's advocate. They mean exactly the same thing. The one who comes when you call. Well, he said that, and then he goes on. He said, this is the Spirit of truth, whom the Father, whom the world cannot receive, because it doesn't see him or know him. You know him because he abides with you and he will be in you. Now, Jesus was trying to console the sad disciples at the Last Supper, and it wasn't working too well, I'd say, because they must have looked a bit like, yeah, it's all very well about the Holy Spirit, we'd like you to be with us, like, you know, don't fob us off to the second, to the Holy Spirit. And so Jesus says, oh, it's all right, relax. He says, I won't leave you orphaned, I'm coming to you. So the Father will send the Spirit, but I'll be there, don't worry, I'll be there with you. Oh, thank you, great. Then he goes on to say, if you love me, you'll keep my word, and my Father will love you, and we will come to you and make our home in you. I think we are here at the deepest part of Christian spirituality, whatever your charism might be. I don't think anyone goes deeper than this. This is the indwelling Trinity. This is God found within the soul, within you, within us, within the church. This is the indwelling Spirit, and because the Spirit is in you, Jesus is there because it's his Spirit, and the Father is there because it's the Father's Spirit. It's the communion of love. So in your heart, Jesus is loving his Father is loving you. That's the Spirit. That's all going on inside all of us all the time. What a pity we get distracted. And if you're living a contemplative life, isn't that where you are? I won't go through chapter 15, 16 and 17 for obvious reasons. There's limits on what I can offer you. But what you'll find there, and they're beautiful, is the extra additions that the disciples of the beloved disciple put in after John died and said, oh no, you've got to put that in as well, that's too good to leave. And then someone found another homily in the top drawer and said, what about this? And they said, yeah, that's great. So they kind of added in and added in. So you've got three extra chapters which John didn't put in, or the beloved disciple didn't, but his disciples did. And good on them, because there it is, part of our text. But I won't do it with you because I haven't got time now. We're going to go to the crucifixion now. And the one scene that's only in John. Meanwhile, standing near the cross of Jesus were his mother. We haven't heard of her since Cana. When Jesus says, woman, has not my hour now come? And then that's kind of there on the backstage, the curtain, we keep watching it, this love feast. We've watched the argument going on. We're at the Last Supper, which is the love feast, and we're listening to all this beautiful stuff. And then we're at the cross, and there's the mother again, the woman, the mother. His mother's sister was there. And we know her name from the synoptics, Salome. She's the wife of Zebedee. And now we find out that Salome, or the wife of Zebedee, is actually Mary's sister. So that makes the sons of Zebedee Jesus' first cousins, James and John. So there's a bit of a family thing going on here. You've got, okay, so there's connections there. There's another Mary there too. Mary's obviously terribly common then, as now. She's the wife of Clopas. Now we know from early tradition, a bloke called Hegesippus, you don't have to remember his name, he's said to be Joseph's brother. And Mary, the wife of... So Joseph's died by this time, but this is Jesus' father. Well, his brother is... And so these are also... She's also his auntie, family. And we know that she's the mother because the other Gospels tell us that, of two of the people we hear about in the Gospels, James and Joseph. There's a few James around. So there's a lot of interrelationship going on here. A lot of Jesus' early disciples were cousins, family. Now, the Romans always allowed family to be at these, however terrible the occasion, and they were very, pietà, it's called. It's the Roman virtue. They always let you take the body and bury it, and like they were very respectful of family connections. It was their main virtue, really. So with all their cruelty, all those were allowed to be there. Mary, the mother, the mother's sister, and the mother's sister-in-law. They're all relations. And here's another one. What's she doing there? Mary Magdalene. Well, it would seem that Mary Magdalene's love for Jesus was so intense that a whole blooming Roman army couldn't keep her away. You try. She was going to be there. And the soldiers said, "Oh, you're not allowed in here." You know? And she said, "I'm going in," and she went in. I don't think you women realise what power you've got in the church. Not yet are they ready to get you ordained priest. Well, don't worry too much about it. Being a priest is one thing to do. The main leadership in the church is love. No one can stop you doing that. And that's the main leadership. And one day we'll grow up and all the rest will happen. But in the meantime, don't sit back. Says he. Mary of Magdala had a lot of power. Pilate couldn't stop her. I think it's wonderful that she was there. Now, when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing beside her, he said to his mother, "Woman," here it is again, "woman, here is your son." Well, be simple about it for a start. If the disciple whom Jesus loved was John, the son of Zebedee, which is an old tradition and probably right, then Jesus, who's the only son of his mother, is doing what every son would do, give her to the care of his closest relation. Because in those days, a woman in public life, she had no insurance, she had no job, she was really just a widow, was in a very desperate situation with no husband and no son to kind of earn money and kind of care. So here's Jesus, one of his last things is making sure mum's okay. We often read it, I have anyhow, and you might have too, we think of John being given to Mary. And that's lovely, and that's what's happening. But that's not the first thing that's happening. The first thing that's happening is Mary's being given to John for him to look after her, which is beautiful too, and simple and lovely and exactly what you'd expect. But he does say to the disciple, "Here is your mother." So Mary at Cana was a symbol of all the Jewish women that had ever longed for a Messiah. Mary here is the mother, is the symbol of all mothers, all Christian mothers, who want their children to be embraced by God. So here she is. We're all her children. From that hour, the disciple took her into his own. Doesn't say what, ta'idia. His own what? His own home, his own love, his own protection. You can add your own noun. All it says is he took her into his own. Then something else happens, which only in John. Since it was the day of preparation, John's probably right, because he often is right on the details, the beloved disciple. Jesus, the Last Supper was Thursday night. Friday was the crucifixion. And according to John, the Friday was the day of preparation. The Sabbath was actually on the Saturday that year. So the two big Sabbath and Feast of Passover were on the same day, a Saturday. That must be right, because all the things that happened on the Friday could not have happened if it was the Passover day. But if you read the synoptics, you'd get the impression that Thursday night was the Passover meal and that Friday was the Feast of Passover. That's the way they appear to put it. They're not worried about the day. They're kind of presenting the scene because it was on the occasion of the Passover. I think it's the simplest way to look at it. It'd be a bit like we used to give out presents on Christmas Eve in the family. We had 8 kids and mum and dad, and so we'd start with dad. So I'm number 7 kids, so I'm 9th on the list, and my little sister was 10th. And we were probably spoilt. Our eldest brothers and sisters thought we were. So we'd give dad his presents. I used to buy him mainly a little packet of shaving, a blade, razor blade. And dad would use it for the whole year, I'm sure. He'd keep, because he lived very simply. He'd be getting this thing and making it sharp again and using it for God knows how long. And then something else, you'd buy mum some little tiny thing, because we didn't have much money, and you'd do it. And then we'd have something for everybody. And then we'd get whatever we'd get. Socks, underpants, just practical, sensible things. Well, let's say it didn't happen, but let's say my father was this is Christmas Eve. Say dad was dying a day before Christmas Eve, on the 23rd. Looked like he was going to die. Do you think anyone would object if we gave out presents on that night? Because he's not going to be there tomorrow. It's as simple as that. Jesus is having a supper. And by the way, it must have been like this because there was no Paschal lamb at the Last Supper. I mean, there was, but it's Jesus. So it's an ordinary meal. It's the last meal, but it's the evening before the Passover. So Jesus gives it a Passover significance. And that's clearly what happens. Well, here's John. And go back to John. Thursday night, Jesus dies on the Friday, mid-afternoon, just when the lambs are being slaughtered for the meal that night, when the sun goes down. That's the whole point of it. Well, back to this. It's the day of preparation. So the Jews didn't want the bodies left on the cross during the Sabbath, especially since that Sabbath was a great solemnity. Feast of Passover. So they asked Pilate to have the legs of the crucified men broken and the bodies removed. The legs broken. Why? Because you die, apparently your lungs collapse when you're crucified. And so you're desperately trying to breathe. It's just an automatic reaction. So you push down on your legs to relieve the weight so you can get a breath. And then you sag again and there's this constant writhing that's going on. So the quickest way to kill anybody was to break their legs so they couldn't. So then they just, this is, they crushed their lungs and died. But when they came to Jesus, they found he was already dead. Well, he's a strong young man. There's no reason to think he wasn't. And he's only 33 or 35 or something. So it tells you what they must have done in the scourging and all of that. They must have nearly killed him. In any case, he was already dead, so they didn't break his legs. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once blood and water came out. Well, it's not water, it's whatever you call it, viscous stuff out of the aorta, and blood. And that's exactly what would happen. So a simple thing happened. Simple, but the beloved disciple watching saw it as highly symbolic. And so, he who saw this, say the writer or the disciples, he who saw this has testified so that you may believe. His testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth. So he's stressing this. This really happened, he says. These things occurred so that scripture might be fulfilled. None of his bones will be broken. None of his bones will be broken is in Psalm 34. And the point being made is, Israel, it's talk about Israel, you may be able to crush people in persecution or taking them into exile, but the bones, which is that part of you which survives, centuries later you can see bones there, but you don't see the flesh. You can't break the bones. You can't actually destroy the people. And to symbolize that, in their little big ceremony, Passover ceremony, they didn't break any bones of the Passover lamb, to symbolize the fact that Israel cannot be broken. Not even the Holocaust could break it, you know. Hitler couldn't. You know, that's what they're saying about themselves. Well, here's Jesus fulfilling all that. They killed him, but they can't break him. And another passage says, they look on the one whom they've pierced. And I'm sure that's something you do often. Resurrection, two scenes, and then I'll conclude. Mary goes to the tomb in John. There's more. The others say Mary and the others, but John likes to have one person on stage with Jesus to make it more intimate and more personal. So he's just got one, Mary. Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. She found it empty. She ran back, got Peter and the beloved disciple, and they ran down, and you know all that. Then when they didn't find it, they went back home and finished off the jigsaw puzzle that they were doing, or whatever they were doing at home, I don't know. But you're not going to get Mary Magdalene to go home. God, she's up front, right of this one. Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white, two figures in white, sitting where the body of Jesus had been, lying one at the head and one at the feet. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" You need two in Jewish law to witness. Well, these are the witnesses of the resurrection. Imagine it how you will, but that's the scene here. She said to them, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." And when she said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know it was Jesus. In all the scenes, you know that. They see him, but they don't know, because they're not seeing him like this. Jesus said to her, here's the personal revelation now. The angels will say, "Woman, why?" He says, "Woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for?" It's almost the same words that he spoke right at the beginning of the gospel. What are you looking for to those two men? Come and see. Who? It's a good question for us to answer. Whom are you looking for? Supposing him to be the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I'll take him away." And Jesus turned and said, "Mary." And she said, "Rabboni." He said, "Look, don't hold on to me, Mary, as though I've not yet ascended to the Father. You go to my..." You can't, in other words, grab Jesus the way you used to. "Go to my brothers and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." So Mary Magdalene went, announced to the disciples, "I've seen the Lord," and told them that he'd said all these things to her. There's a lovely statement, it's in my commentary, of one of the popes, Pope Gregory the Great, who comments on this beautifully and talks about Mary. This, it's because Mary stayed and didn't go away and persisted in looking that she saw him. "If you search for me with all your heart, you'll find me," is the point of that. And it's one way of seeing the risen Christ when he calls you by name. A week later, so there's a scene then at the Eucharist. Everybody's there and they recognise Jesus, but they don't recognise him. It's both. And Thomas is not there. Don't know where he is. But the next week, Thomas is there because they said, And he said, "I'm not going to believe any of this stuff." He says, "Unless I put my fingers into his wounds." And because Thomas knew Jesus, and Jesus wasn't going to put a note under his door and under somebody to say, "Look, let Thomas know, will you?" Thomas knew that he'd come and see him too. What are we talking about? So a week later, his disciples are again in the house, and Thomas this time is with them. It's the importance of being to Mass on Sunday for the people. If they're not there, they'll miss out too much. Our young people are missing too much by not being there. "Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.' Then he said to Thomas, 'Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand, put it on my side. Don't doubt. Believe.' And Thomas said..." Please note, it doesn't say, "And Thomas put his finger in the wounds, and Thomas put his hand in the side." That's how you would describe it if you were describing a miracle. No. Jesus is inviting Thomas to do that, just like he's inviting us. John is inviting us to do that. to put our fingers into the wounds of Christ. Where are they? Well, they're here, and they're here. Jesus on the road to Damascus, I am Jesus and you're hurting me. So whenever anyone, when I was hungry and you gave me to eat, I was thirsty, I was in prison, you visited me, you know all these scenes. So the wounds of Christ are all around us, and we will meet the risen Christ when we put our fingers into the wounds and hold the heart of the person who's despairing. And so Thomas says, my Lord and my God. So John has two bits of advice for us if we want to see the risen Christ. One is we must look on the one we've pierced on the crucifix. Just look at him. And the other is we've got to roll up our sleeves and put our fingers into the wounds in the best way we can according to our vocation. And finally, excuse me, there's the scene, lovely scene, in the appendix. There's a lot in the appendix and it's very important, and I won't go through it with you because of time, but it's very rich. You know, they go out fishing and so on, and this is added after that, and they talk about the death of the beloved disciple and all of that. When they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, sometimes called son of Jonah, so I'm not sure what his dad was called, really. He can't have both names. But anyhow, that's him. And he says, and I've given you the Greek there because I think it's important. So just watch. Agapan, or agape is the noun, and philein, or phileo, philia. There's two words, there's a number of words for love in Greek, but they're the two words that you need to watch carefully. They mean different things. Agape means love in the sense of hesed of the Bible, and it's love like, it's not feelings, it's not friendship, it's love meaning commitment, care, giving yourself to another even if you don't feel good about it. So it's commitment. Phileo means friendship, affection, love in the, more in the sense that we might use it in everyday. So let's get the questions because they're quite important. Jesus says, Simon, son of God, do you love me more than these? In other words, are you committed to me? Can I trust you? Can I rely on you more than I can rely on the others? Because he'd said at the Last Supper, the others might all go, but I'll be there. Even if the others all run away, I'll be with you. I'll die with you. So Peter's learned a bit of humility now. He doesn't even answer that question. Some translations put yes as though he was agreeing and saying yes, but he's not. He says, Lord, you know I love you. Phileo. Which is another way, I think, of saying, I don't know whether you can trust me. I let you down on Friday night, you know, Thursday night in the garden. I'm likely to do it again. I don't want to do it again, but I wouldn't trust me if you were sensible, because I'm a bit untrustworthy. You know, all that's behind this. But look, I love you. And that seems to be enough for Jesus. It's rather cute, really. He says, feed my lambs. Knowing that if he loves Jesus, if you love him, well, we'll make mistakes and we'll hurt people and we'll want to sin, hopefully, whatever our life will be. But don't leave that. And that's what Jesus wants, because the rest will grow from that. Then Jesus says to me a second time, and notice what's missing, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Agape. Can I trust you? Can I rely on you? Will you be dependable? But he doesn't say more than the others, because that's gone. All that stupid pride. Peter's answer is the same. Lord, you know I love you. Oh, well, says Jesus, look after my sheep. And then something happens that's quite hurtful and troublesome to Peter, because Jesus asks a different question. The third time he said to Simon, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And notice that he changes the word, phileo. Are you really my friend? Do you really care about me? And poor Peter says, oh, come on. You know everything. You know I love you. I mean, I don't mind you doubting whether I might be faithful, because I've shown you that I'm not, and I mightn't be. But don't you question my love, you know, my phileo. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. So it looks, if I've understood it correctly, that as far as Jesus is concerned, yeah, we can't be sure we'll be faithful. Please God, we will be. And to the extent that we haven't been faithful, it's forgivable, as long as we learn from it and don't repeat it. Try not to repeat it. But the key of it all is love of Jesus. And that is love of God, because God is beyond all love, really, in a way. But Jesus isn't. So it's our love for him. That's the Christian thing. Our affection for him, our wanting to be in him, our letting him love us, which is even more important, that's the key to the Christian life. And it's the end of John's Gospel. So.